Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush applauded the new government in Iraq today, but a recently returned journalist asks, have the martyrs already won? We'll have more on that in a moment, but first, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice never mentioned Iraq as she delivered the commencement address at Boston College today. Since the announcement of Rice as speaker, the campus has hotly debated her visit, critics saying her role in the Iraq War conflicts with Boston College's Jesuit mission. Today, Rice remembered her own Catholic education and said she respects the ideals of Boston College.
As an academic, I'm honored to be here at Boston College, a place of learning that is respected today, not just in America, but throughout all the world. As a student of a Catholic high school, the Sisters of Loretto taught me, I am pleased to be at an institution of higher education with such strong and celebrated Catholic and Jesuit traditions.
Well, here now is Monica Brady Meyerhoff, is at Boston College, and she was there for Condoleezza Rice's speech today. She joins us on the line. And Monica, overall, how was Condoleezza Rice received?
She was very well received, I'd say. The number of people who stood up to honor her and give her an ovation when she came to the podium was much greater than about the 50 students and I'd say 30 or so faculty members who stood up to protest for receiving an honorary degree and giving the commencement speech.
How did they do that? Did they stand en masse when she received her degree? How did that take place?
The conflict seems mostly over her receiving an honorary degree, and many students were wearing white armbands that said, no honorary degree, and they held up signs that said, not in my name, and they turned their backs to her while she received the honorary degree. And when she turned to her commencement speech, everyone sat down and listened politely. But there was a plane that flew overhead dragging a sign that said, your war brings dishonor.
This has been a controversy at BC for weeks now, with about 1,800 students and faculty signing petitions against Secretary Rice receiving, as you said, the honorary degree, saying the school should be, and others saying the school should be honored to have such a high-profile speaker. What sense did you get after her commencement speech, Monica? Because in listening online, we were surprised that here she is, the Secretary of State. She never once mentioned the war in Iraq, or at least not that we heard.
Yeah, she mentioned it in passing, but this was not a policy speech. This was more boilerplate graduation speech. She talked about where she came from, her roots in a very segregated city in the South, and how she used education to get out of her situation and achieve what she wanted to achieve. She told the students to find their passions, to use their reason, and cultivate humility, things that you probably hear at commencement speeches across the country. Really, the only war she mentioned was the football war, the rivalry between BC and Notre Dame. And that was all she talked about, wars, in this speech.
We should mention that one adjunct professor at Boston College quit his job in protest over Condoleezza Rice coming to the school. He, Steve Allman, saying that he felt that she had lied in the past in the run-up to the war, and that alone should have been reasons for her not to be invited. And we should point out that Steve Allman is also our occasional literary critic here on Here and Now. But others have been saying that given polls, given public opinion polls, it seems somewhat odd that the protest was as muted as it was. What are you hearing from people?
Well, the ones who were protesting had very articulate reasons why they were against her. They said inviting Condoleezza Rice and giving her an honorary degree goes against the ideals of the school. This is a Jesuit institution, and one student told me that supposedly they stand for social justice and peace as a Catholic institution, which it would be against war. And the Pope John Paul II came out against the war in Iraq. And yet Condoleezza Rice was honored with a law degree, with an honorary law degree. And another student said that he believes that the Bush administration could be held guilty in terms of war crimes and terrorism. So he said to give her a law degree seems hypocritical. So those who held those views held them strongly. I would just say they're in the minority here today.
And we point out, too, Vice President Dick Cheney spoke at Louisiana State University, LSU, last week, and there were only about 30 protesters outside and not much protest inside. So this is apparently what this graduation season is going to see. Here knows Monica Brady Meyerhoff at Boston College for today's commencement speech by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Monica, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
President Bush says the United States has entered a new chapter in its relationship with Iraq. Speaking today in Chicago to business people, the president said this weekend's inauguration of Iraq's new unity government is a victory for the cause of freedom in the Middle East.
The unity government has strong leaders that will represent all of the Iraqi people. I called them this weekend to congratulate them. I thanked them for being courageous and strong and standing for the belief that liberty will help transform their troubled nation.
Well, violence in Iraq claimed 17 lives today. President Bush and administration officials have expressed confidence in the past that a new government would help stop the growing number of killings and kidnappings in that country. But journalist Nir Rosen isn't so optimistic. He spent months gaining access to Sunni and Shia militia members. He speaks their language. And he wrote about his experiences in his new book, In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of Martyrs in Iraq. We recently spoke to Nir. We thought we'd spend some time today. He told us that Iraq is already in the middle of a civil war.
You have people dying in very large numbers. You have militias operating openly. You have a government that is weak, non-existent. Sunni and Shia militias are fighting each other all the time. You have raids at night. In the morning, you find all the dead bodies. It's not yet open or declared. That's the one thing that might, perhaps you can call it an undeclared civil war. Mm-hmm. Both of the main parties in the civil war have refrained from actually admitting that they're doing this publicly. But everybody knows they're doing it, and each side knows the other is doing it. The main side on the among the Shias is the Mahdi army, the militia that belongs to Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical cleric. And they control the police and the army. They are the police and the army in much of Iraq.
Well, let's talk for a minute about Muqtada al-Sadr, because he really figures into the title of your book, which is In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of Martyrs in Iraq. According to Shia belief, martyrs live in paradise in the belly of a green bird below the throne of Allah. And al-Sadr's father and uncle are both considered martyrs. Would you say that he has already triumphed?
Yes, I would. I would say he triumphed on April 9th, actually. It just took a great deal of time for people to realize this. He is the single most powerful individual in Iraq. I saw him speak outside of Najaf about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it was like being at a Michael Jackson concert. I mean, you had more than 10,000 people just screaming in adulation. They were so excited that they actually got to see the great Muqtada al-Sadr. Women as well were very excited. Young people were rushing the fences just to shout to him that they supported him. Nobody else in Iraq has this kind of following. People who are willing to die for him, they really view Muqtada as their representative, as their defender, their voice. He speaks colloquial Arabic like they do. Unlike some of the exiled leaders, he was actually there, and he capitalizes on that. He was one of them. He suffered with them. His father was killed by Saddam for opposing him.
And as you said, you feel he triumphed on April 9th, the day that the statue of Saddam Hussein came down, because in pulling down Saddam, the U.S. in effect raised Muqtada al-Sadr.
We opened the doors for his people to take over. There was a vacuum, and they filled it, along with various other militias and armed gangs, but primarily the followers of Muqtada al-Sadr.
Well, and what's interesting is, as I said, you spent time, well, with a lot of clerics. You sat on a lot of rugs, and you spent time with Muqtada al-Sadr. What did you think of him?
Well, he was quite young. He still is. And all the other leaders were far more aged, and they spoke in a more elegant and classical Arabic. His was far more vulgar and colloquial, a street Arabic, which actually has endeared him with a poor Shia, so he speaks their language. I guess you could call it Arabic Ebonics in a way. It's just slang, street Arabic. You know, he was being interviewed by me and a couple of the journalists, and he used some equivalent of like, hey, man. He struck me as inexperienced and uneducated. But this hasn't been a problem for him because he hasn't claimed to be very well educated or experienced. He just claims to be one of the people.
Do you think he's bright?
I just don't know. I can't figure it out. And nobody, I don't know if anybody knows who are the brains behind Muqtada al-Sadr, who's actually writing his sermons. I mean, his sermons are heavily political. He often talks about this evil triad of America, the UK, and Israel. He's been voicing concerns about their influence in Iraq really from the beginning of the occupation. He's claimed that the Americans are encouraging sectarianism, and they've come to divide Iraq. This, unfortunately, has happened. Iraq is getting more and more divided, and sectarianism has increased. So his fears have come true. He's often warned about Zionist plots to divide Iraq, to take it over, a bit conspiratorial, but there is this perception that there is a Jewish threat as well. Responding to various American declarations like early in 2003 in the occupation, the Americans vowed that Iraq wouldn't have a religious government or government like Iran, or that the Quran wouldn't be a main source of law. And Muqtada quickly condemned this in his sermons and rejected this as something that the Iraqi people as well reject, that they do want Islam to have a significant role in their government, and that the Americans had come and were imposing their will on the Iraqi people.
You write about religious courts. Tell us about those and how they might affect, you know, the long-term stability in Iraq.
Well, clearly they are oppressive. I mean, you don't want to be a woman living in those kinds of conditions. They are not exactly following any sort of legal procedure. You don't really need many witnesses. It's just ad hoc. They arrest a guy that they don't like, and they can beat him or imprison him at will. It's just another militia. I mean, in a way, religion is being used as an excuse here to eliminate the competition.
We're talking to Nir Rosen. His new book is called In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq, people like Muqtada al-Sadr, who he feels have triumphed. You heard all of this firsthand, without interpreters, on the street, in the mosques, yourself. Tell us a little bit about you.
Born and raised in New York. My father was born in Iran, so he bestowed upon me the right kinds of features for working in the Middle East. And I just fell in love with the region, and particularly with the Arabic language, after having friends in school from Palestine and Lebanon. I picked up the language from them and studied it on my own. But in Iraq was just a very intensive immersion program because I couldn't afford translators as a freelancer. You just had to sort of sink or swim, and I had to pick it up as fast as I could, the unique Iraqi dialect in particular, because that's what people speak there.
There are moments where it gets you into places. There are moments, you know, it gets you into terrific trouble. There's one moment where you got a call from a friend who lived in a Shia stronghold, but a Sunni mosque had been attacked near his house. He said they were Wahhabis, you know, the conservative Sunni Wahhabis. And you ventured out in a taxi cab, and soon enough you were blocked by a truck and about 20 men pointing Kalashnikovs at you. What did you do?
Well, I wasn't sure if they were Sunni or Shia, so I just tried to convince them I was a friend, and a friend of all of their leaders, and reassure them that I was not a terrorist or a threat. This was the spring of 2004. After a succession of attacks against mosques and against Shias in particular. And the Iraqis were growing more and more nervous and more scared of strangers, of outsiders coming into their neighborhoods, because this was happening on a daily basis, these attacks. And the only thing they could do was form these neighborhood militias, ad hoc militias that would protect them from anybody coming in, especially at night when some of the most gruesome attacks were occurring. And I took the stupid risk of actually going to one of these places at night when nobody else goes, to be the first one to get the story, and was very lucky to come out of there alive.
Journalist Nir Rosen, he's author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of Martyrs in Iraq. He's been working as a freelance journalist in Iraq, and he's had remarkable access to militias there, primarily because of, as he says, his looks, and he speaks the language. So what did he hear? More with Nir Rosen when we come back. Much more coming up. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation with Nir Rosen, author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of Martyrs in Iraq. In his book, Nir Rosen documents a litany of events from 2003 that he says undermined U.S. forces in Iraq. For example, at an early meeting, Iraqi leaders asked if Americans were liberators or occupiers, a charged word in a country that saw the Crusades, and the U.S. official who responded said, somewhere in between. In Tikrit, a brigade commander said that he wasn't there to win hearts and minds. He was there to kill the enemy, Iraqis. In Bakuba, U.S. forces killed two 13-year-old girls digging through trash along the roadside, presumably because of fears of roadside mines. And all of these things, Nir says, compiled to erode Iraqi faith in the U.S.
There were daily Abu Ghraibs, a constant humiliation, and the arrest of innocent people, rounding up of entire villages, all the men. Most of them were innocent. In front of their children, in front of their family. So what do you expect? The Americans are doing this, and all the neighbors know that this guy is innocent. He's working actually with the Americans, in one example. And yet, if this is how the Americans are treating innocent people, How can they claim to come here as liberators? Surely they are the enemy. I mean, the American actions, even if they were blunders sometimes, convinced the Iraqi people, Sunni and Shia, that they were not there as liberators.
Well, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice recently said that the U.S. made thousands of mistakes in Iraq. We recently talked to a general who pretty much said the military is now sort of regrouping and reissuing orders and rules to soldiers who've never, you know, who weren't trained for this kind of interaction.
It's just too late. I mean, Iraq is no longer even about the insurgency. The American presence is not the most important part of the Iraqi story anymore. Iraq is about the civil war that's been raging since 2005. The Americans are just one more militia among the many militias there now.
When was the shift away from the U.S. forces and towards each other?
The shift was really when Shia militias started taking the fight back to the Sunnis and stopped being on the defensive. And this occurred in 2005 when Shias took over the Ministry of Interior. Shias had already de facto control over the police and the army just because Shias are the majority. Poor Shia followers of Muqtada Sadr were the ones most likely to join because they needed the money. Sunnis were boycotting the security forces, leaving it open for Shias to join in even greater numbers. And when Shias took over the Ministry of Interior, you suddenly started seeing, this is in 2005, in the spring, raids into Sunni neighborhoods, mass arrests of Sunnis, executions, and Sunnis became scared and intimidated, telling like, wait a minute, we thought we were the majority, we thought we had the power, we thought we were intimidating the Shias, and now we're being victimized. Our neighborhoods are being raided by these nebulous forces. Are they police? Are they Shia militias? Is it the same thing? This is when it happened. And they began to fight back, and they began to divert their resources to fighting Shia militias. And the Americans just became one more militia. And when the Americans would attack Shias, Sunnis would cheer. When the Americans would attack Sunnis, Shias would cheer.
What do you think has to happen now, Nir Rosen?
I'm not going to offer solutions because I don't think there are any. I think Iraq is at the point of no return. I just got back from Iraq about 10 days ago, feeling more depressed and more worried than ever, both for the country and in particular for my friends over there who I leave behind, worrying that I might never see them again because they live in neighborhoods that are just so violent. The warfare is open and it's daily and it's constant. The dead bodies are in the street every day. Both sides at this point are committed to fighting to the death. And if the Americans were to try to do, let's say, the right thing, to de-sectarianize, de-militia the security forces, take them away from the followers of Muqtada Sadr, they would incur the wrath of tens of thousands of Shia men who have fought the Americans in the past. Let's not forget the Shia uprisings of 2004. They call them their intifadas that prove that they are also anti-occupation. They are willing to fight the Americans again should the Americans threaten their interests. In a way, I think soon you'll see Sunnis being worried about the American departure and Shias calling for it more and more. I think you're going to start seeing, as these Shia forces start pushing Sunnis back, you're going to see the Sunni Arab neighbors joining in, because throughout the Sunni world, there's this fear of a Shia Iraq. And sectarianism has spread throughout the region. And many of the Sunni Arab tribes in Iraq have kinsmen in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. They're not going to stand by and allow these Shias, that they view in almost a racist way, as Untermenschen, as an underclass, is not really deserving to lead. They're not going to allow these Shias to take over Iraq and to punish Sunnis, who they think are the real Muslims. They're going to go join in the fight. This is going to draw Iran into the fight further. You're going to see clashes between Sunnis and Shias in places like Lebanon, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain. What I think we're going to see is a vast regional type of sectarian war. I'm really, really concerned for the region.
Well, and that is a pretty depressing view. The Iraqi president, the U.S. coalition forces, the President Bush, the White House, they all say that once a government is formed, that this violence and this sectarian violence that you talk about will abate.
Yeah, they've been going through milestone after milestone, every time pointing to a milestone, the elections, the handover of sovereignty, various battles like Fallujah or Mosul. We've turned the corner, we've broken the back, and yet the violence has grown worse and worse. Obviously, the Americans can't admit that there's a civil war in Iraq for political reasons. I mean, that would be an admission that the whole project is a horrible failure. The government in Iraq is just not important. Things in the green zone, now called the international zone, are a theater for international consumption. But the people inside the green zone aren't the people controlling events on the street. They're removed from, let's say, the red zone. That's the real Iraq. And they have no real control over them. The government itself is just a collection of various militias antagonistic to each other. They've been taking over various ministries. For example, Muqtada Sadr's followers took over the ministries of health and transportation. They cleansed them of all Sunnis and of ideologically unacceptable Shias, filled them with Muqtada Sadr supporters with no experience or qualifications, allowed clerics to take over, and these ministries now are barely functioning. Health and transportation, which are both key for the survival of the country. The same thing with the Ministry of Interior, stripped away from Sunni officers who may have had some experience. Unknown Shias were brought in who have a vendetta against the Sunnis with some good reason. But these are not organs of the Iraqi state. These are organs of various sectarian militias. It's just too late. What can you do? You can't take it away from them because they'll be fighting you.
Journalist Nir Rosen just returned from Iraq. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we spoke to Nir earlier this month, as he said, just after his return from Iraq. His new book is In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of Martyrs in Iraq. Well, this note, today the National Hurricane Center predicted 4 to 6 major hurricanes in the upcoming season, but they say conditions don't seem to point to last year's record activity. Promise? Well, tomorrow we'll take a closer look at the hurricanes ahead. Stay with us, much more ahead today, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A law that's never been used to prosecute journalists might become a new weapon for the Bush administration in what it says is its struggle to protect national security. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is suggesting that a close reading of U.S. law shows reporters could be prosecuted for simply publishing information that's classified. He made his comments yesterday on ABC TV's This Week.
We have an obligation to enforce those laws. We have an obligation to ensure that our national security is protected.
Well, journalism advocacy groups are already crying foul. Joining us on the line is Professor Stephen Burgard, director of the School of Journalism at Northeastern University here in Boston. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be here.
And let's distinguish, because with a quick reading of this over the weekend or this morning, some people have thought that the Attorney General was referring to what is common knowledge, which is that reporters can be called into court to testify about people who gave them information, their sources. This is a distinction.
Right. It's a real distinction to be talking about prosecuting reporters for publishing information as opposed to trying to find out who their sources are or jailing them for refusing to reveal sources.
Yeah. And so this would be about printing something. And on television, the Attorney General wasn't specific about the law he was referring to, but reporters are speculating that he meant the 1917 Espionage Act. Tell us more about that.
Well, there's a 1917 act that goes back really to World War I era times, and it hardly can be imagined as something that would have been construed to prosecute journalists in the 21st century. Typically, what you might think about in a law like this going that far back would be whether or not someone would publish information or release information, not necessarily publish it, with respect to troop movements or, you think of World War II, the possibility of if you knew that the government had cracked the Japanese code and you were then in some way making that information available, that's the kind of release of highly sensitive national security information, especially in a wartime setting, that might be damaging to the national interest.
Because we'll remind ourselves, the Espionage Act makes it a crime for an unauthorized person to receive national defense information and transmit it to others. Well, of course, that does, that in that category would fall reporters and journalists.
Well, that's subject to debate and question. There's some debate in the journalism community as to whether or not this law is so overly broad as to be unconstitutional or enforceable in this particular area. The government in currently has a case involving, I believe, some Israeli lobbyists. It's essentially dusted this legislation off to use it in that particular case. But now to expand it and apply it to journalists involving a couple of very specific instances of what's been published would be a real extension.
These are the lobbyists who were accused of receiving and transmitting classified information from a Defense Department official. But Attorney General Gonzalez's comments came in response to questions about the New York Times story last December The first one that revealed that the administration is wiretapping some communications going in and out of the U.S. without court warrants. This is the warrantless wiretapping program that the NSA is doing. So in your opinion, does the New York Times reporting on that story compromise national security?
I can't imagine how it does. It's simply reporting how the government is going about gathering information in a general sense. It's not the same thing as having released the identity of a sensitive target in an investigation or anything like that. It's simply pointing out, really doing its job by making it clear that the government in this particular case is conducting wiretaps of conversations without going through the normal procedure of going to court to get a warrant.
And the Bush administration is saying that that is classified information. But our question is, if in fact they were able to at all carry out this, what is now amusing about the law, and say that no journalist could print any classified information or be subject to being charged, couldn't the government just classify all information so that there could be no reporting?
Well, it's certainly the scope of what comes under the umbrella of classified information could be expanded for any number of purposes. And in fact, this is an old argument. This is not, although the Bush administration has been especially narrow in its reading of public information press access questions, a lot of administrations have done this in the past in some form or other, usually a lesser form, to try to argue that there's a national security reason not to publish information. In fact, Ben Bradley, back in the Watergate days and thereafter, used to talk about how so much of the information in Washington that the government tried to argue was national security wasn't really about national security at all. So it's not really a new mm-hmm. strategy, but if you're talking about prosecution, that's a different level. Yeah.
Well, this comment from the Attorney General, coupled with the reports of the warrantless wiretapping program and another program that USA Today says that the government is undertaking, which is collecting phone information, has apparently already had an impact. ABC News journalist Brian Ross last week said that the government is keeping track of calls made by New York Times and Washington Post journalists, and that a government source advised him and his colleagues to change their cell phone numbers. But we also heard him on NPR say yesterday that, in fact, he and other investigative journalists are simply doing more gumshoe work. They're simply trying to meet their sources face-to-face as opposed to leaving a trail.
Well, reporters are very resourceful about getting their sources to meet them behind a potted plant somewhere. So that's always going to be something reporters can do well. But the case of Brian Ross and Richard Esposito of ABC News is really another example of the press doing its job. They've basically been reporting on CIA prisons abroad, something that would clearly be newsworthy and in the public interest to know. We don't have to know everything about every top secret detail, but the fact that we are holding people abroad or have been, that in addition to the warrantless wiretaps, are the kinds of things that the press ought to be going after to let the public know what's going on in the war on terror and what's happening in this era of the war in Iraq.
So do you think that the Bush administration might actually follow through and make it a crime for journalists to print classified information?
Well, I think if we saw prosecutions in this case, it would create a real uproar, and one would expect that there'd be some real second thoughts before going forward with prosecutions here.
So what do you think this is all about?
Well, it's a serious matter. The White House is clearly narrowing the area in which it wants to conduct this war on terror and so forth, and the battle lines are drawn here. I would personally be surprised to see prosecutions, but you never know.
Professor Stephen Burgard, director of the School of Journalism at Northeastern University here in the Boston area. Professor, thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
And still to come today, last week we reported on the good job prospects in many fields for this year's college grads. Well, we hope intern Daniel's mother didn't hear that report. He's already under enough pressure, as you'll learn. You're listening to Here and Now. Kentucky Derby winner Barbaro is said to be recovering today from surgery to repair his leg, which broke in three places in front of thousands of horrified horse racing fans watching Saturday's Preakness Stakes. Well, at least they didn't also have to see this beautiful thoroughbred destroyed. Barbaro pulled up lame just 100 yards or so out of the gate, but he was taken to the University of Pennsylvania's New Bolton Center for Large Animals, where surgeon Dean Richardson told the Today Show today surgery may have saved his life, but it will not enable him to race.
There's absolutely no chance that he can race again. What we're trying to do is make him, give him a leg that will make him comfortable, adequate for him to become a satisfactory breeding stallion.
Joining us now, Jenny Reese. She covers horse racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal. And Jenny, you were at the hospital this morning. How is Barbaro doing?
He's doing fine. I mean, he's made it past the first two big hurdles. One, when he came out of the anesthesia, he came out of it well. Sometimes they thrash around and can cause more damage. And he also was able to stand immediately on all four limbs, distributing the weight equally. You know, we're still talking months to go to make sure he's out of the woods, but he didn't have to make it this far, and he has so far, so that's great news.
Well, an amazing treatment. We're looking at some of the pictures, actually, in today's New York Times, pictures of this huge pool of water that he was put into after the surgery on a raft that would protect his legs and hoists and belts that have lifted him around, and he's transferred on a monorail. I mean, it sounds incredibly high-tech.
It is incredibly high-tech, and he's got a lot of metal in his leg now. He's got 23 screws and a metal plate with like 16 holes in it. He's getting all the top care, that's for sure.
Yeah. We know that some animal activists don't like to see horses racing at all, but people who call themselves animal lovers say horses love to run, and everyone seems to agree that, in fact, they don't do well if they aren't at least a little active. So, I guess they're looking to see some activity from him.
Right. Horses, the way they're designed is they can't go for long periods of time prone, laying down, because their internal organs just don't function properly if they're laying down. There's also so many other things that can go wrong still. The problem is the area below the knee of a horse, there isn't a lot of tissue that gets blood down there. And if you have such severe fractures, you can disrupt the flow. And you need to have circulation down there to promote healing and also to get the antibiotics to the affected area. The great news about Barbaro is that when they went in to do the surgery, they found that the blood supply was in pretty good shape. Still, as Dr. Richardson said at a press briefing yesterday, he said, to be brutally honest about it, it's a toss of the coin with the horse making or not. And I thought that was fantastic news, because at the start of the day, I thought it might be 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 that Barbaro would be able to survive.
For all of us, this was just a wince moment, even if we don't watch horse racing. What was it like for you, who was so involved in this field? And, what are you hearing from other people? Why is it that this has been so devastating?
Well, it's devastating any time a horse has a catastrophic injury, but you're talking about a Kentucky Derby winner and an undefeated Kentucky Derby winner and a horse that many, many people thought was really the goods and that had the best chance we'd seen in years to be racing's first Triple Crown winner. The race starts, and before you could hardly blink an eye, he's being pulled up. And it's just, a gasp from the crowd of 125,000 people, which was a Preakness record. It was a gorgeous day, and just watching it, you just feel sick to your stomach. And I remember having to tell myself, you got to watch the rest of the race. You got to find out who won. And it was like, who cares? The next morning, Sunday morning, I was talking to Dan Hendricks, the trainer of Brother Derek, who was the second choice and who ended up finishing fourth. And I asked him after a time, what do you think of the winner? He goes, who was it?
Well, right now, his doctor says, he may never race again, but he will have a breeding career. And there's that sense of it. I mean, I guess these animals become like children to people, and I'm guessing that as devastating as it is that he won't race, people are happy that, pulling for him just to be around.
Absolutely, and hoping that someday he has babies that make it to the track. As Dr. Richardson emphasized, it's not over by any means, but just hearing the idea that it might be 50-50, that was just fantastic news, yeah, because it had been so grim going into that.
Jenny Reese covers horse racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal, talking about Barbaro, the racehorse who pulled up lame at Saturday's Preakness Stakes, and now has, a 50-50 chance of making it. Jenny, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Graduation season is in full force. College seniors across the country leaving their bubbles of academia to enter the real world, and we're not talking MTV. It's a daunting prospect for Here and Now intern Daniel Estrin. What, working free for a radio station isn't doing it for you? He's one of those graduating seniors. He's trying to figure out what to do with his life, and he put together this audio postcard about his anticipation, his angst, and all that advice.
What do you do with the BA in English? What is my life going to be? 4 years of college and plenty of knowledge have earned me this useless degree. I can't pay the bills yet, 'cause I have no skills yet. The world is a big scary place, but somehow I can't shake the feeling I might make a difference to the human race.
That's one of the opening numbers from the new musical Avenue Q, and it pretty much describes exactly what I'm going through right now. I'm graduating from Brandeis University with a BA in English. And although I've read some great books these past 4 years and amassed plenty of knowledge, college has not taught me what I'm supposed to do next. Now, this I do know. Once I have that diploma, I'm going to be financially independent. No help from mom and dad. And that's scary thought number one. Scary thought number two, since I'm not going straight to graduate school, all my options are open. And luckily, some of my friends are in the same boat.
I'm Dara, and I tell everyone that my plan for the rest of my life is to be confused. Sometimes I think that I'm not going to ever find anything, that it's just sort of a lost cause. But I don't know. People tell me that something will come along. I like to believe them.
Hi, I'm Wendy, and I'm sort of in the process of looking for a job in public relations and marketing. I must have sent my resume to 100 places.
My name is Robin Katz, and I'm going down to New Orleans to volunteer for about 6 weeks. I've got plans till July. That's about it.
My name's Justin Olin. I did gymnastics for 12 years, so I'd like to get back into that and try out for Cirque du Soleil. When I called my mother and told her about this, I thought she was going to freak out, but she's like, oh, I always thought you were going to do something like that. So I'm going to get back into gymnastics, do some training, and see if I can pull this off.
Well, I'm not going to join the circus, but I am still brainstorming. I could move out west to sunny California and find any old job just to unwind for a year. I could follow my passion for writing and journalism and try to make ends meet as a freelancer. Or I could just pick up, go abroad, and learn a new language. Well, as exciting as it is to dream, the real world is approaching, and I'm feeling the pressure.
Well, I don't know if that's my motherly advice, but it's my motherly concerns, Daniel, that we've talked bits and pieces, and the last time we talked, I mean, you're all over the map. You want to go to teach English in France or travel to Thailand, or maybe you'll go to Israel. It just sounds like you're all over the map, and I don't really understand why you feel you have to go travel the world all over. You know, there are certain family members that both you and I know. They've taken a year off after college, and they've traveled the world over, and it's the best experience of their life, you told me. But they're directionless.
So are you worried about me?
That's my job to worry about you, Daniel, of course.
But
I always worry about you.
You think I'm directionless, Mom? You think I'm aimless?
You have a misconception about what it means to be a professional, what it means to have a career. There is no shame in having a career. Look, Daniel, here's what I really would like you to do. There's someone here in St. Louis who's very well known, Dr. Rose Jonas. She's a PhD. She's a career coach. She apparently has this incredible gift for helping people like you who have wonderful, wonderful talents figure out exactly how to put those talents into a niche. I would have a lot more peace of mind if you'd be able to go and make an appointment with Rose Jonas and have her help you figure out where to go from here. Would you be willing to do that?
If it means your peace of mind, Mom, anything.
All right, Daniel, it does. It means a lot to me.
So I took my mom's advice and called Rose Jonas, job doctor and life coach, and I asked her point blank, how should I plan my life?
Planning your life is a daunting task, and I think there are probably 5 people on the planet who know how to do that. You don't happen to be one of them. You sound very much like the people in your generation. you are somebody who is not ready for the 9-to-5 job, who has dreams and aspirations that are not quite defined, that you have more exploring and experiencing to do. When you talk about traveling the world, I happen to believe that that's a key component of education for somebody your age. If you have not traveled the world, if you have not worked in the world, you will not be able to compete in the world. You're one of the most interesting generations to come along. You're called Generation Next. You are absolutely looking forward to doing work. You're absolutely looking forward to making a contribution as a generation. You have a keen sense of social justice. You're more likely to be an activist than if, for example, you have an older brother or sister. You are more likely to extend the time post-college to do exploring before you settle down. But you have a value system that's going to absolutely fit into the world of work when you get there. So I think that your generation stands to make a very important mark. It does not stand to make a mark if you do what your parents did. You know, I love parents, but I call them my job security, because they will tell their child to do what they wish they had done, what they think they should be doing now. For example, they'll often say, you need to settle down and get a job for 20 or 30 years. Well, no company's doing that kind of hiring right now.
Right. It's very reassuring when you say graduating seniors like me can explore and we can travel the world and find more about ourselves. But as much as I want to travel, as much as I want to explore, I'm concerned that I won't be able to pay for it.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, and that's who's footing the bill. And you know the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules. So if you're someone whose parents are paying the way, you have a more difficult task. If, however, you are paying your own way, then you get to say to your parents, I'm responsible for myself. Never again in your life will you be able to get along with very little money. And I think you'd be wise if you could figure out, you know, gee, I need $10,000 to get by for a year, and this is how I'm going to do that. If you know that, I think your parents will feel differently about your adventure because you're approaching it in a responsible way, and you'll feel ready for the adventure because you know how you're going to pay for it. You know, my feeling is, what the hell? Go do it. You know, you've got nothing to lose by scratching together a few $1,000s and going to do something that is appealing and interesting to you.
And that's exactly the kind of advice I need to hear. To trust my gut, find something that feels right for now, and go from there. And besides, I'm getting ahead of myself. I mean, I'm graduating. There'll be plenty of time for me to freak out about my future. For right now, I think it's time to celebrate.
Our audio postcard was produced by our intern and Brandeis graduate, Daniel Estrin. Congratulations, Daniel, and many thanks for all your help this past semester. By the way, we'll miss you, but anybody else want to be an intern? No pay, but you can maybe put your mother on the air. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Molly Hamill, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shergetz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer is Kevin Donovan. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna, who says, seriously, we need interns. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.